truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, streaming around the planet. Well, last night here in Oregon, I'm broadcasting from the banks of the Willamette River. And here in Oregon and in Kentucky, there were primaries, as I'm sure you've noticed. And Hillary Clinton, a 2-1 win in Kentucky. Barack Obama, not quite a 2-1, but a substantial victory here in Oregon. And last night, I found myself screaming at the television, and specifically at Norah O'Donnell. And here's the message that I thought I was hearing as I was listening to the election coverage. They kept going to her for analysis of the vote. You know, let's break down the exit polls. And basically what I kept thinking that I was hearing her say, now these are my words, not hers, but those of you who saw MSNBC last night, saw the election coverage, in fact, I'd love to hear from you, 866-303-2270, whether you think I'm crazy or not. But what I thought I heard her saying, and I certainly thought I heard Pat Buchanan and some of the other commentators essentially saying in subtext was, well, yeah, those folks out in Oregon, those mostly white folks out in Oregon, they did vote for Barack Obama. They did vote for the black guy. But, you know, they're the exception in this country because they're just so weird. They are so liberal out there in Oregon. You can't use them as any kind of barometer or metric for anything about what could happen in the real election, because really what we've discovered here is that white folks won't vote for a black guy, and Oregon is the exception to the rule because they're just so, they're crazy, they're so liberal out there. That was the message that I thought I was hearing. So I wanted to just to do a reality check on this and bring in a real Oregonian here. I've only lived here 3 years, and a guy who has his finger on the pulse of what's going on in Oregon, probably more than anybody else in the political realm. Kari Chisholm is the publisher. He's the president of Mandate Media and the publisher of BlueOregon.com, which is the premier political blog in the state of Oregon. And BlueOregon.com, you can check it out. Kari, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Did you catch MSNBC's coverage? Did you see what I saw? Did you hear what I heard last night?
Actually, I was at running from election party to election party. It was our primary here, and I had a lot of friends running for office, so I missed the coverage. But I got to tell you, I saw a lot of it in advance. New York Times and the National Public Radio referring to Oregon as a largely white but affluent state. Which is about as incorrect as you could possibly get. Oregon, Portland is an affluent city, but the state of Oregon in general is certainly not an affluent state. This is a working-class state. Our average annual income in the state is $2,000 a year below the national median. 3 years ago, we were the number one state in the country for hunger. I don't want to badmouth my own state here, and we've made huge strides in combating that. This is certainly a working class state that forever has been a state based on natural resource. A timber economy for a lot of years.
And a fishing economy, and both are collapsing. And this is a state that's experiencing some real economic distress.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again,
not unlike Ohio. I mean, it's just we're not the Rust Belt; we're the wood and fish belt, I guess. But it's we're having crises here.
Yeah, you know, it is a very white state. That is true. And Portland is certainly, they call it the People's Republic of Portland sometimes. But when you get outside of Portland, and that to me is what's so disappointing here, is we've got national media who are coming to Portland and they're hanging out in our very excellent coffee shops, and they're not getting on the road and going out and seeing the real Oregon.
Yeah, and the subtext of this, in my mind, is frankly racist. Or somehow a failure on the part of many of these commentators, and perhaps an intentional failure on the part of the more conservative commentators, to even understand, what they mean when they say liberal, or else to they're back to using the old pejorative definition of the term, you know, the bleeding heart liberal. Oh, well, they just vote for that guy because they want to embrace everybody because they don't understand how the world works, all that kind of nonsense. And in fact, Oregon, And you and I had this conversation on our local show on AM 620 KPOJ here in Portland yesterday, as I recall, or maybe it was the day before yesterday. Portland, or Oregon in general, is about the most average state in the United States, so much so that companies do their test marketing here.
That's right. We get strange products in our fast food and strange new combinations of soda pop. We get all kinds of strange products here that people are test marketing. It's part because Oregon is, there was a study done about a year ago, we're the most average in all the sort of demographics. Our racial profile actually matches the national profile. Our socioeconomic profile matches the national profile, although just a little bit below average. Our urban-rural mix roughly matches the national average. And that's true both in the commercial world and also true in the political world. Oregon is a place where political activists, especially conservative ballot measure activists, test drive a lot of ideas because we have such a wide-open ballot measure culture, and we have one major media market, Portland, Oregon. And so it's fairly cheap to try and, affect the outcome of elections here. Oregon is a swing state. Al Gore only won the state in 2000 by 7,000 votes. John Kerry was campaigning here right up to the end to win it.
He only won by 4 points.
We have fairly consistently gone for the Democrat, but that's a lot of work and a lot of folks who...
And we have a Republican senator and we have a Republican member of Congress.
We're the only state on the West Coast with a Republican U.S. senator, and we will, by the way, defeat Gordon Smith this fall with Jeff Merkley, who won the Democratic primary last night.
Yeah, congratulations to Jeff. Great victory.
Yeah, it's a big win. We're going to have a progressive in the United States Senate from Oregon to match our other senator, Ron Wyden. But this is a swing state. There's a lot of folks that work very hard to make it look easy here in Oregon. Every year we expect to, compete hard. It's actually going to be a fairly competitive state this year. John McCain does better here than most of the other Republicans that they could have put up.
Right. Well, Ron Paul pulled 14% or 15% of the vote last night, didn't he, in the Republican primary?
I think that's right. And Barack Obama's win here, which was about 58-41, and was a statewide win. There were certainly some counties in the eastern half of the state where he split with Hillary, but he didn't just win in the Portland metro area. Barack Obama won out on the coast in Lincoln County, where there's more cows than people. He won in Jackson County and Josephine County and Curry County on the southwest corner of the state. Barack Obama's win.
These are very rural, relatively low-income areas. These are not the yuppie outposts that people think of incorrectly think of rural Oregon as being.
He won in Wallowa County, which is in the northeast corner, as I like to say, the Idaho part of Oregon, the hometown of our Senator Gordon Smith, the Republican. So, he won in
Barack Obama won.
Barack Obama won east and
right.
west,
so,
and north and south.
So we've got two things here. Number one, Barack Obama's victories in Oregon can drive a stake into the idea that working white people or low-income white people will not vote for Barack Obama. And number two, this is a genuine question to you, Kari, in the minute and a half we have left here. How can we push back against the national media that has bought this storyline? I mean, they get their teeth into a storyline and they just never let go, that has bought into the storyline that somehow there are some states that are just so liberal that they don't represent the rest of the country, and Oregon in particular is one of them, and therefore don't pay attention to that victory by Barack Obama last night.
Yeah, it's completely nutty. Oregon is, as I said, the most average state in the country. We are a swing state. For decades, we had a county, Crook County in Oregon, that was the bellwether. It was the only county in America that always voted for the winner of the presidential election. We'd go back and forth. Barack Obama's win here in Oregon, actually, I think tells you very clearly that if you're test marketing political candidates, this is a guy who can win across the entire country. I think the what's really going on with Hillary Clinton, and I think you've talked about this, is that she's very strong in Appalachia. And if you take a map of the counties where she has won 65% of the vote or better in the entire country, and you highlight them, and you look at a map of that compared to a map of the Appalachian region, guess what? It matches. She did very well all the way from southern New York and western Pennsylvania, all the way down to northern Mississippi and northern Alabama, through West Virginia and eastern Kentucky. She has basically dominated in Appalachia. She's the queen of Appalachia, which is great. But Barack Obama's winning the rest of the country.
Yeah, and Appalachia is not representative of the rest of the country the way Oregon is.
You're right.
Craig Chisholm, publisher of BlueOregon.com. Check it out, BlueOregon.com, for more commentary along these lines. Kari, thanks a lot for dropping by.
You bet.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
I was screaming at the TV last night. Welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Because I kept hearing commentators saying, essentially, oh, those folks in Oregon, they're so liberal, they'll even vote for the black guy. I mean, that, in my opinion, that was the undercurrent of what was being said. And it was just so wrong. By the way, we now have, there are 86 delegates that can be acquired in an election, 86. And there are 214 superdelegates who have not yet committed. At the moment, Hillary Clinton needs 246 delegates to lock up the nomination. Barack Obama needs 64. So I think this is a done deal. My sense of it is that Hillary Clinton is running for vice president right now. And as I said yesterday, I think that would actually be a good ticket, and I think it could be a winning ticket. I know a lot of people are. What has happened is in the Democratic Party there has been such polarization. The Clinton people are saying that they'll never vote for Barack, and the Barack people are saying they'll never vote for Hillary, and all this kind of thing. And I think it's a tragedy and a shame. And yes, I am very familiar with her negatives, as I am with all the arguments that the Clinton folks make against Barack Obama. I still think that this is a ticket that could win. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Richard in Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I agree with you. I was yelling at the TV last night on MSNBC as well. Did you hear David Gregory say something about, he was talking about liberal orthodoxy and how Barack could win over the Appalachian vote. And he basically said that Barack has to reject affirmative action to win over that vote. I thought that was the most insane thing I heard last night.
Yeah, see, this is all these people trying to put this whole racial spin on it, and I mean, let's keep in mind, Barack Obama, I mean, race really wasn't even an issue until the whole Reverend Wright thing came along. He had managed to keep the campaign above that. He is the product of a biracial marriage. His mother was white. But you don't hear these guys referring to him as the half-white candidate.
Nope.
It's like, he's the black candidate. Wait a minute. He's an American candidate. Let's talk about America. And that's what he did so brilliantly in his speech last night, is he talked about America. And I want to hear more conversation. Thank you, Richard. Well said. I want to hear more conversation about America, and I'd like to hear our candidates referred to as Americans rather than as men or women or black or white. This is just crazy. Leslie in Portland, speaking of Oregon, listening on KPJ.
Hi. Hey, Leslie. I just wanted to point out that Oregon is often called the Appalachia of the West, and that at one time in our history we had a huge Ku Klux Klan contingency. So I don't think we're all
one of the largest in the country actually in Oregon. And Seattle is wealthy way up at the north end of the West Coast, and then you got L.A. and San Francisco down doing pretty well down in the south end of the West Coast. But here in Oregon we're kind of in the middle. And yeah, we have been referred to as the Appalachia of the West. And so you're agreeing with Kari Chisholm's analysis that we're really not this liberal bastion, but that this is a pretty average state.
I am. And I also want to weigh in on the vice president thing. Mm-hmm. I think because of Teddy Kennedy, Hillary will want to stay in the Senate. And I want to say that I really trust Barack Obama to pick the right person.
Yeah, I will absolutely second that, Leslie, and thank you very much for your comment. I absolutely agree, and whoever he picks, I'll be assuming that he's the nominee, and I think that that's a safe assumption now. whoever he picks, I'll salute. Carol in Queens, New York. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for informative and intelligent conversation every day.
You're welcome.
I wanted to say, it's not just last night, just a few minutes ago while I was waiting to speak with you, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times made the most condescending statement that I've heard today. I hear them every day, but today. She said the difference between Oregon and Kentucky is that is the difference between latte drinkers and instant coffee drinkers.
See, that's my point, and that's BS. It's total nonsense.
And then last night I was so proud of Ron Reagan. He brought the comment up. He said, it's not Barack Obama's problem. Barack Obama is not having a white problem. He said the people in West Virginia and Kentucky seem to be having the problem, not being able to relate to him. So he doesn't think he's having this cross the board white problem. And as the mother of a very intelligent, very successful junior in college, full scholarship basketball player, biracial child, who looks up to Barack Obama. You know, I'm so with you on this. He is an American thing, because it's so frustrating to me the way that they have tried to blackenize Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And instead of looking at the merits of his argument and his positions. And it's deliberate, Tom, and I'm just so frustrated by it. And I just want to thank you, because I'm so glad you brought that up today, because it just seems like this continual drumbeat, and especially from the mainstream media, we're picking up all the memes of the Republican Party and playing them over and over and over again. And if I hear one more person in the mainstream media call us the Democrat Party instead of the Democratic Party, drives me insane.
That's an old slur that Joe McCarthy started. I mean, you know, it's absolutely spot on, Carol. And by the way, it's the corporate media, not the mainstream media. This is the mainstream media. But, you know, your point is perfectly spot on. Thank you so much. And let's keep in mind, 2 days ago, Barack Obama made the offhand comment in an interview that he thought that the Sherman Antitrust Act should be enforced and some of these big media corporations should be broken up. Does that have something to do with this kind of racist coverage?
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more about that at Teamster. That's singular, not plural. Teamster.org. Barack Obama needs 64 more delegates. There's 86 up in the air to be voted on and 214 undecided superdelegates. And I have a feeling a few of them are going to start dropping like flies. We'll see how this all comes along. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And, you know, I just want to add, before I go back to your calls, and I know there's a whole, you know, the board is totally full, as it usually is, but nonetheless, I have to add this. I remember, and I've told you, people who are regular listeners to this program have heard this story before. Howard Dean was on the cover of Newsweek. He was on the cover of Time. He was the fair-haired boy or golden boy or whatever the crummy cliche is for, you know, everybody assumed he was going to be not just the nominee of the Democratic Party, but that he was going to kick George Bush's butt from one end of this country to the other. And frankly, I think he would have. And in the Iowa primaries, or the Iowa caucus was coming up, and Dean is sitting there with Chris Matthews, doing one of those live things in front of an audience of kids at a college or whatever it was, and somehow the issue of the media comes up. And Howard Dean says, I think the big media monopolies should be broken up. And Chris Matthews gives him this look like, did you just fart loudly or something? I mean, you know, basically that kind of look, like, you know, I can't believe I just heard you say that. And he says, you mean break up the companies that own it? And Dean says, and this is all from memory, so this isn't, these are not verbatim quotes, but you know, Louise and I were sitting there watching this happen with our jaws falling open. And Howard Dean says, yeah, he says, I don't think that, you know, big companies, these big combines should be allowed to own, you know, multiple media companies. It shouldn't happen. And Matthew says, you realize that this show that we're on MSNBC is owned by NBC, which is owned by General Electric, which is also a defense contractor. And Dean says, yeah, I think it should be broken up. And Matthew says, you're calling for breaking up this network? And Howard Dean says, yeah. Now, that day, as of that moment, he was the presumptive nominee, and all the media loved him. The next morning, on the morning shows, on the big network morning shows, the question for the day is, why is Howard Dean so angry? Which was code for, why is Howard Dean crazy? And he was portrayed as the crazy candidate from that point forward by the corporate media. And 3 days ago, Barack Obama said, and frankly, I wish he hadn't. Just do it, right? Speak softly and carry a big stick. But Barack Obama said essentially the same thing. And now we've got all this commentary from the big corporate media machine out there. Oregon, it's the most liberal state in the country. Didn't you know that? And that's the only reason they voted for him. And he's, you know, subtext, he's unelectable. Which is exactly, I think, what the Republicans want. 1-866-303-2270. That is to say, I think that the Republicans want to run against Hillary Clinton. Chris in Cave Creek, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Tom. I just want to tell you, you are my personal hero, sir. You are my absolute personal hero. I love your books.
Thank you.
And your kindness and what you do to put the message out there.
Thank you, Chris.
I agree with you absolutely about Barack Obama. But I have a question for you, and maybe you can help me clear this up. I heard that the delegates at the convention are the ones who select the vice presidential candidate. Am I wrong?
I'm not sure, and in fact, we've been Googling like crazy since you first called and mentioned this to Carmen, you know, who's answering the calls there in New York today. And as far as we can tell, the delegates do have the you know, they're the ones who pull the lever, push the button, whatever. It's their vote legally for vice president. But historically, the vice presidential candidate is actually chosen by the presidential nominee and put forward by the presidential nominee, and the delegates just go, you know, yes, we'll salute that flag.
Oh. Okay.
But there's some speculation that what Hillary Clinton is trying to do is push the delegates to push Barack Obama to put her on the ticket as vice president. That might be part of, you know, one of the reason why this endgame is being played out, even though she needs 246 delegates to win, and there are only 86 delegates that can be, you know, that still have not been picked in the remaining three races to come up. Barack Obama only needs 64. That perhaps this has something to do with that. And frankly, I am not enough of an insider with Democratic politics to know. And my guess is if we got on, you know, Howard Dean or Susie Turnbull, that they, being super insiders, wouldn't say. So, we'll just have to see how it plays out. But,
well, thanks, Tom. And thank you for everything that you do.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. I do appreciate it, and thanks for your kind words. Charles, in Los Angeles, listening on KTV.
I'm calling from Los Angeles, black American, and met a whole lot of white working class people when I worked on Swan Island in Portland.
There you go.
Good people, good hardworking people, didn't have any problems with racism or anything like that.
And they're voting for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And
so, you know, I think Oregon is more representative of the United States than West Virginia.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. And I've not lived in West Virginia, but I've certainly spent time there, and I've lived in Oregon for 3 years. And as Kari Chisholm was saying, we are the cross-section of America here.
Yeah, and America has changed. I mean, you even look at Senator Robert Byrd, okay? He had a former Klansman come out for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And so now I'm hoping that that both Byrd and Kennedy live long enough to see this man become president.
Yeah, especially Kennedy. This is so tragic, this cancer that he has. It could be very, very fast moving, and you know, he is in my prayers every day. I hope he's in all of ours. And for those folks who don't pray but send light or whatever, you know, whatever you do, you know, you do it. It's just a tragedy. Charles, thank you for your comments, and thanks for the call. Well said. Robert in Vancouver. Hey, Robert.
Hi. This is Robert in Vancouver, Portland metropolitan area.
Yeah, Vancouver, Washington, I should say.
Yes. Yes. I'm an Ask Me member, and some of my fellow union members do vote on God versus financial interest. And I noted that MSNBC was not the only one participating in Oregon bashing. CNN had dissected the demographics and compared the 8% of people in Kentucky that say they have no religion to the 28% in Oregon that say they have no religion when they were polled. And they made a big thing about that, like, oh, those heathens. I mean, they did everything except for call us Little Beirut, like George
right.
Sr. did.
Yeah.
It was pretty
now,
pathetic.
That 8 versus 28%, I'm guessing that was probably of Democratic voters, not of Americans.
Correct.
Yeah.
But they did make a lot of hay out of a statistic that they kind of massaged into place, you know.
Yeah. I think that they're just trying to devalue the win and write it off and trying to elevate the wins that Hillary Clinton has had in Appalachia as this represents America. And I don't want to take anything away from Hillary Clinton's victories. You know, God bless her. She's done well. And frankly, I think that the main reason why she won by such a large margin in Kentucky and West Virginia wasn't racism or anything like that. I think it was because she and her husband and her daughter were on the ground there a lot. I mean, the three of them were just hitting town after town after town, and all three of them are rock stars. And Barack Obama basically didn't campaign in those two states. And I think that that counts for a lot. I can tell you, I've lived in small states. I lived in Vermont. I lived in New Hampshire for almost 5 years. I lived in Vermont for 10 years. I've lived here in Oregon for 3 years. And in small states, when a rock star shows up, people talk about it for years. And they will be talking about it, you know, the Clinton visits to those states for years. And as they, so anyway, I think that that's the bit. Robert, thanks a lot for the call. It's, well said. We'll just see how this all plays out. Howard in Tascadero, California, listening on 1430 AM. Hey, Howard. Howard, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. I want to thank you very much for your program. My wife and I are avid listeners. We're both 80 years old. We're for Obama, and we're concerned about electing the Democrats. I think we all agree that there has to be a healing between both wings of the party, Obama and Clinton.
Uh-huh.
I have a suggestion that I think could work. We need help right now in the gasoline problem, and if Hillary and Obama would join together and push for the windfall profits tax now, they'd have a motherhood issue, and they'd lead the way, and McCain would have to follow.
Yeah.
And I think it'd be a good way also for Hillary to leave on a high note and be a winner.
I think Howard, you make a good point. There's nothing wrong with a little populism out there, and even if it is a gimmick, it's gonna win with a lot of people. Let's just do it in a way that has some integrity and some honesty associated with it.
Right.
Yeah. Howard, good point. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio. 866-303-2270, your telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop by our live chat room. And Sean today is going to be checking out her favorite post of the day on our show blog at tomhartman.com. We'll give away a copy of my book, The Prophet's Way. Stick around.
The truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Timothy Egan over at the New York Times today, Outpost, the blog, the opinion blog, White on White, talking about this issue. He points out that George Bush won West Virginia 52-46% in 2000, 56-43% in 2004. He won Kentucky 57-41% in 2000, and 60-40 in 2004. You know, these are areas that are solidly Republican. He says, this is Clinton's heartland, but it does not resemble the Democratic landscape. And then he goes on to Oregon and talks, basically says what I've been saying. The state, he says, but rich it is not. The state is below the national average in both per capita income and median household income. This suggests that Obama doesn't have a white working class problem, so much as a regional problem, in a place where Democrats won't win anyway. Ernie in Rush, Kentucky. Speaking of Kentucky, hey, Ernie, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I'm an Obama supporter, and needless to say, I was a little disappointed with the results last night, but I expected that. And I agree. I believe it's a regional problem, and if Barack Obama's going to have a chance there, he needs to go there. He needs to visit, he needs to spend some time there. But still, yeah, I mean, when 2 in 10 people... And this is NBC's numbers. They were saying last night 2 in 10 would actually admit saying that race was a factor in selecting Hillary over Barack Obama. You know, there's a problem there.
Yeah.
And I think the only way that problem can really be addressed is he has to go there. He has to speak. He has to, you know, let those people, know what he's all about.
Right. And he has to diffuse that whole thing. A lot of these folks are, white folks are people who have never had any kind of meaningful interaction with somebody of color. And you're absolutely right. He needs to meet them. He needs to talk about his background. He needs to talk about both his African father and his white mother. He needs to talk about, in one way of diffusing that. Number two, just present himself as an African American. I mean, most African Americans are kind of just like most white Americans are really, a hodgepodge of different, you know, a long lineage of racial and ethnic backgrounds. And, you know, we're all Americans here. And I think that, you know, the face-to-face, palm-to-palm, getting to know people, that's the stuff that will break through that. And it'll help break down racism in those areas. And that'll be a good thing for America as well. Ernie, thanks a lot for the call. You've well said. I appreciate your comments. And Scott, Virginia Beach, Virginia, I'm contradicting myself.
That's what I want to talk about. But if I can just get off track a bit, I'm a 55-year-old disabled vet. I've been a long-time liberal. What that other guy was just saying, let me tell you the biggest problem that Obama's going to have is a lot of people like me. Now, I'm going to vote for him. But a lot of people like me who would never have considered themselves racist think we're being called racist in this campaign. If Geraldine Ferraro's racist, if Bill and Hillary Clinton are playing the race card, well, there's a lot of us that are offended by that. And it's not Obama. I'll tell you the truth. It's the liberal talk show hosts that are doing that thing. And I'm not a racist, but I've been very offended this whole campaign.
So you think I'm calling you a racist?
No, I'm saying when Geraldine Ferraro says that she was put on, it's not an advantage to be a woman, but to be Mondale's vice president, it was an advantage. When she says it's not an advantage to be a black guy, but if you wanted to give the keynote address at the 2004 Democratic Convention, it was an advantage. And she's called a racist for that. That irritates us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
but what I was saying was, when I was watching that thing last night, I said, well, that's just what Hartman was saying. You said yesterday or the day before, the most liberals are in Oregon. And I just blogged up an article by...
Oh, yeah. That was, in fact, that was the conversation I had with Kari Chisholm. And one of the points is that the most among liberals, you'll find the progressives, that some of the most progressives are in Oregon. Among conservatives, you'll find some of the most extreme conservatives in Oregon. And the reason why is because we are an average state, and therefore they test market, and this is Kari started to make this point earlier in the show, they test market these ballot initiatives in the state. These hardcore right-wing ballot initiatives with all this out-of-state money come into this state, and they test drive these things, and they have polarized our electorate. But in terms of demographics, this is a very average state. And in terms of, you know, the numbers of conservatives versus liberal, rural versus urban, income, all that. Yeah. And I just
blogged up his article, Chisholm. He says the average Kerry voter was the most liberal in the country.
That's right.
Okay. Well, that's what we're saying. If That's what they were saying last night.
But see, that's not the
liberal Democrats in the country are in Oregon, so you would think they would vote for Obama. And I always thought that's what you were saying the other day. To hear you say this today, it's unbelievable to me. I'm a fan of yours, so don't take this personal. But that's unbelievable. I've always thought of Oregon Democrats as liberal, real liberal.
Yeah, many of them are, and many of them are not. And the profile of Oregon overall, broadly speaking, matches the profile of America overall. I mean, that's the bottom line, and I think it's an important point to make. It's an important point to make. And to say that, oh, Oregon is somehow an exception, no, Oregon is not an exception. Yes, there are liberal Democrats in Oregon. There are conservatives in Oregon as well. But that's not what was going on yesterday. It's absolutely what was not what was going on. Richard in Kirkland, Washington, in the hey, Richard, got about a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour. What's up? Richard?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I had a question about impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry it's not on the subject today.
Go ahead.
How else do we stop the administration from invading Iran?
Well, I think impeachment is the remedy if they were to do it. I mean, Chuck Hagel brought this up yesterday,
but
suggesting that...
I know Bernie has a thing in Congress, a bill, but how is that going to stop them if they want to invade? Or is it even impeachment going to stop them from invading?
It's a damn good question, Richard. I'm not sure that anything can stop George Bush from invading Iran.
That's
if
what
he
I'm
decides
afraid
he wants
I'm
to do.
I'm sitting here just wringing my hands. I don't think there's any
yeah.
more immediate threat to our world well-being right now than that.
It is a serious issue, and it's one that we need to take seriously.
And
impeachment, you know, basically removing him from office is, as far as I can tell, probably the only way to do it, and I don't think that there's any chance that's going to happen. So, you know, we just have to... Actually, the other thing that will prevent him from doing it is rational voices within the White House. His Secretary of Defense, Mr. Gates, is apparently opposed to this. Condi Rice apparently opposed to it. So we'll see how this plays out.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman Program.
Going on and on about the progressive point of view of the elections last night, let me just put a fine point on this, on the Oregon thing about, you know, Oregon having the most liberal Democrats versus Oregon being the most liberal state. There is a significant distinction between those two things. Oregon is by no means the most liberal state in America. Most of the state is rural. Our average income in this state is $2,000 below the national average. We have more people in poverty than most states. We're below the median there. We have worse unemployment than the median states. We are average, or if you want to get into, you know, white working class, average or slightly below average. That's this state. And yeah, many of the Democrats within this state, many of the Democrats within the state are more progressive, in quotes. In other words, in favor of things like, you know, single-payer national health care or in favor of progressive candidates than the average. But it doesn't really in a huge way show up in the electorate. I mean, that I would say is a small metric. We have a Republican senator and a Democratic senator. Peter DeFazio is one of our members of the House of Representatives, a Democrat who is arguably one of the most progressive in the House of Representatives. But we also have some fairly middle of the road. Darlene Hooley, who is just retiring from the 5th District. Very, very middle of the road. This is a very, very middle of the road district. And that, I think, is how we can get. And we have a Republican, you know, from representing Oregon in the House of Representatives as well. So to say that Oregon is the most liberal state in the country, or even one of the most liberal states in the country, is just utter nonsense. And it's important to draw the distinction between the two. Fred Lucas is with us. Fred is with CNSNews.com. CNSNews.com, he's a staff writer there. And Terry Jeffrey usually is dropping by. Fred, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And, you know, CNS News, I know you guys don't have a big banner at the top that says we're the conservative news source, but I'm guessing your perspective is a little more Republican, you personally anyway. Your perspective is more Republican or conservative than it would be Democratic or liberal.
I'm planning down the middle.
Okay, all righty. playing it down the middle, what do you think about last night? First of all, what's your take on what happened last night in the elections, both on the Democratic side and particularly on the Republican side? Here we had in Oregon, for example, I think either 14 or 15% of the Republican primary voters voted for Ron Paul.
That's not too surprising. I mean, once an election is over, which it is on the Republican side, you might have some of the more activist voters and maybe even some folks who sort of like Ron Paul that normally wouldn't vote for him when it's really a contested election that would cross over and cast that kind of vote.
Mm-hmm. So to what extent do you think that John McCain has a problem with his base? It seems to me that there are I don't think he's broken 80% in any of the last four or five elections. And people voting for Ron Paul, people voting for Mike Huckabee, people still voting, and there's all this hysteria in the corporate media right now about how Hillary Clinton won by 40 and 41% in the last couple of West Virginia and Kentucky, but John McCain lost to Mitt Romney by over 80% in one election in Utah, obviously a Mormon state, but nonetheless over 80% and over 45% in two other states.
Well, my guess is that the McCain, I mean, he will have a tough time unifying the party because he has deviated from on so many issues over the years. But if he can pick the right running mate, right being the operative word probably, someone to the more conservative than he is, and also another thing he does have going for him is that this Democratic primary has been divisive enough that numerous polls have already shown that. Roughly one-fifth of Democratic voters right now, at least, are saying that they're going to bolt the party and vote for McCain in the fall. And
right.
And in that sense, he's very acceptable to swing voters. If Barack Obama has once there's more talk about his liberal record, both in the Illinois legislature and in Congress, as people start focusing on Reverend Wright again or Bill Ayers, he may have a tougher time in the swing states, and McCain is very strong among moderate independent voters. And Republican voters, if they're concentrating on things like the judiciary, they're going to, I think, stay home.
Right.
Or stay in the base.
Right? They'll stay in the base, and the base will show up, you think, at the end of the day.
Right.
But isn't it a problem for the – I mean, are we not watching the disintegration of the – semi-neoconservative, semi-libertarian, pro-free trade, pro-corporate rights, the ability of people to sue corporations, pro-tort reform, let's say. Basically the robber baron wing of the Republican Party. I realize that's a pejorative term. You probably wouldn't use it, but I don't know how else to describe it. Basically, I mean, there's been this constituency within the Republican Party. You've got a whole lot of Republicans who have traditionally always voted in the favor of corporate interests and against the interests of working people, and they gussy it up in a variety of ways by saying, we're in favor of personal responsibility when they're voting for the bankruptcy bill. And there's Democrats who did the same thing, by the way. But the bottom line is that there's been this pro-corporate wing. And it seems to be disintegrating.
Well, I wouldn't like portray McCain as any kind of socialist or anything here. I mean,
you're right. He's got over 50 lobbyists working on his campaign.
Right. John McCain was opposed to the housing bailout, which he thought was too much big government. He has been strong on a pork barrel issue. Now he is willing to take on a lot of corporate interests. And which I think, if anything, that's going to help him. A lot of Republicans within the base feel like the party has become too corporate, and that's why we've seen over the years support for people like Pat Buchanan. And in this past election cycle, we've seen a lot of support for, obviously, McCain and Mike Huckabee.
Right. We're talking with Fred Lucas. He's a staff writer at CNSNews.com. And, Fred, Chuck Hagel has come out and denounced the war in Iraq, and yesterday said that Bush, essentially, these are not his verbatim words, but the essence of what he said was that if Bush were to invade Iran, he should be prosecuted or impeached in the House of Representatives. And this has endeared him to many Democrats who I think are unfamiliar with his voting record, where he has voted with the president more than 90% of the time as a senator from Nebraska, two-term senator from Nebraska. But there is talk of Hagel being a running mate with Obama, and there's also talk in the Republican side of Hagel being a running mate with McCain. What are your thoughts on all this?
I can't imagine him being McCain's running mate. But, yeah, I did read a piece in the Washington Post over the weekend from Dave Ignatius, I think, suggesting that Obama choose either Hagel or Bloomberg, and that would in the sense that Obama's rhetoric has been that he transcends partisanship, he transcends ideology, but his actual record is that he's never really sponsored too many bipartisan bills other than an ethics legislation with Tom Coburn. But beyond that,
well, and also doing away with nuclear proliferation and loose nukes.
Right. Okay. Okay.
I mean, you look at Chuck Hagel's voting record. Okay. He's got a 100% NRLC, you know, pro-life stance, 100% vote with them. The NAACP only rates him at 11% on civil rights. This is Chuck Hagel. His pro-business voting record, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce rates him 87%, very, very, you know, pro-business, anti-consumer. He voted the NEA only 34%, mixed record on public education. Cato gives him a 92% pro-free trade voting record. I don't see how a Democrat could have him on. The Christian Coalition rated him 100% as quote, pro-family, you know, which basically is anti-birth control.
That would be a tough pick, but at the same time, it could be helpful in the sense that it would neutralize the fact that Obama does have a pretty liberal record and that his
record. But why does that
really
need to be neutralized?
Of being,
why does that need to be neutralized if America is becoming more liberal? I mean, Chuck Hagel has an 8% voting record with the, according to the AFL-CIO. He's very anti-union. Don't you think most Americans would like to have a union job?
That's possible.
So
it might even be more likely that he would choose someone like Bloomberg, who is almost a Democrat, but has shown that he can transcend some party lines and also be a good manager.
Yeah, he used to be a Democrat, and then he became a Republican, and now
right.
He's an independent.
Right.
Interesting. Well, Fred Lucas, thank you for your perspective. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Fred Lucas, a staff writer over at CNSNews.com. You can read his work over there. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Just trying to digest the meaning of last night's primary election. And where's the party going here, the Democratic Party in particular?
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
Chuck Hagel, a 0% rating, indicating opposition to progressive taxation. Chuck Hagel on tax reform. He voted yes on raising the estate tax exemption. Yes on supporting permanence of estate tax cuts. Yes on permanently repealing the so-called death tax. No on a $47 billion repeal of the capital gains cut to increase the yes on retaining reduced taxes for capital gains and dividends. You know, basically, right across the board, every single time voting yeah for the rich folks and no for, you know, Chuck Hagel is a Republican. I mean, it's just very simple. I don't get it why Democrats are talking about let's put Chuck Hagel on the ticket, other than that some blogger in the Washington Post said, hey, this is a good idea. And Hagel has come out and spoken against the war in Iraq. And, you know, God bless him for doing that. Here's a man who was he's a Vietnam vet. He knows what war is. He knows what kind of hell war is. He and his brother Tom both signed up and went off to Vietnam, and I salute them for it. And he gets it. He gets what kind of hell George Bush has inflicted on on both the people of Iraq and our soldiers. But that's not enough to make him a Democrat, I'm sorry. This morning, Pat Buchanan, this note from Bill, I rarely, you know, without double checking and triple checking and sourcing and whatnot, would share this kind of thing, but it, I have heard similar language, so I'm guessing that this is totally accurate. He says, "A morning Joe this morning, Buchanan, Pat Buchanan, talking about the difference between white Appalachians and white Oregonians, called white Oregonians conscience free. And apparently the term that the corporate media has decided to use to characterize Obama now is exotic." He says he's heard Pat use that term twice. Thank you, Bill, for that. Jeez. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com, although I think the Air America website has been a little sputtery today. It should be back to normal tomorrow. Is it Sousa or Susan in Seattle?
Susan, yes, hi.
Susan.
I wanted to talk to you about the corporate media, but I also wanted to say, I think, okay, it'll be a horrible choice. It would just give some of those crazies that agreed with what Mike Huckabee said reason to do something, and that scares the daylights out of me.
Yeah, Chuck Hagel also has a 0% rating by NARAL. Zero.
Yes. Exactly. But what I wanted to say about what you were, you said that you think that corporate media has gone this racist route right after Obama talked about breaking corporate media. And I think it started before that. It started in Pennsylvania. It started with that survey that I think the Financial Times did in West Virginia. And so I don't think it postdates his comment on that. However, having said that, I think now that we are aware of what happened to Howard Dean, and we are aware of what they can do, we need to be alert, and there's a lot more media now than there was 4 years ago, to combat them to the point where we might even make them have to bend over backwards to prove that they're not doing it.
Yeah, I very well said. Thank you, Susan. I appreciate your comment and totally agree with you. Richard in Stratford, Connecticut. Hey, Richard.
Hey, I'd like to point out that McCain's problems with the religious right are far greater than Obama's problems with the working class Democrats. He lost by very large margins in states that he needs. And in fact, he lost West Virginia as well as Obama, and by a larger margin.
Wait a minute. John McCain lost West Virginia in the primary?
Yeah.
I thought he won, but by like 70% or something.
No, McCain lost West Virginia by like 45% or something close to that.
Huh. I'll have to. Well, Louise is off Googling it right now, but in any case, I agree with your broader point that John McCain has a problem with the fundamentalist base,
and even after Huckabee dropped out, Huckabee was still drawing a large number of people to vote for him.
Oh, sure. But see, the corporate media is not going to talk about that at all. All they're talking about is, Barack Obama's got a problem with white people. And say what?
You know, well, every once in a while, when I'm not in this area, I listen to the right side of the radio.
Sure.
And Rush Limbaugh was killing McCain.
Yeah.
I mean, they hate him.
Yeah, but they, you know, wait until September, October, November. They also know that solidly 80%, and some people would argue as many as 90%. I've seen estimates that only 6 or 8% of people are actually paying attention to politics until 3 months before
Hillary drops out.
Say what?
Couldn't the same be said for when Hillary drops out, that her supporters will, when looking at McCain,
I think a lot of them will. I think probably most of them will. I think that what we're looking at right now is the base on both sides. And the base relative to the electorate is relatively small. And the people who are seriously paying attention to politics are probably solidly less than 20% of the electorate and maybe even less than 10% of the electorate. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And I'll tell you, there's strange things going on in the sky.
Ghost chickens in the sky.
Ghost chickens? Or is it a painted pigeon? I've warned you before about those pigeons. You know, they're robots in the planet Xenu. How do we know? Because, number one, you never see dead pigeons. Number two, you never see baby pigeons. And number three, whenever there's big meetings of world leaders, what do you have? Thousands of pigeons. They're tape recorders. They're little robotic tape recorders. And now here's the story. This is from the Associated Press. When Yosuke the parrot flew out of his cage and got lost, he did exactly what he'd been taught. He recited his name and address to a stranger willing to help. However, he kept mum with the cops. When he was taken to the police station, he would not talk to the cops. But a few days later, he talked to the veterinarian, and he recited his address. And the vet said, we checked the address, and, you know, the family there said, yeah, that's our parrot. But what if this is actually proof that it's not a parrot? Maybe it's another robot. Maybe they're starting to paint pigeons to look like parrots and chickens and all kinds of things. Who knows? Who knows?
Ghost chickens in the sky.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyhow, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Yes, it is tongue-in-cheek. Charlie in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on Winds 940 AM. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Hey, two things, Tom. First of all, I just got an email that somebody had forwarded me. There's a smear campaign about Barack Obama and Michelle Obama going around. Human Events has one called The Real Barack Obama, and then the Michelle Obama one is about her thesis at Princeton. Supposedly she was in favor of black separatists, so people should be aware of this.
Yeah, Snopes has already debunked that, by the way. The quote that they pull out of there is actually an accurate quote, but it's so out of context that it literally reverses the meaning of what she said.
Yeah, the entire email that I got forwarded was all distortions, lies, basically, most of it. But my ears perked up during the MSNBC coverage last night. Norah O'Donnell chirps in response to a question by Olbermann that there are five liberal states, she said, and those are Oregon, California, Massachusetts, New York, and New Mexico. No basis, nowhere she got it from, but that's what she asserted. There are five liberal states. So,
oh, that's very strange. That's very strange. I mean, how do you come up with this stuff? They just pulled it out of her hat, I guess. Charlie, thanks a lot for that. I didn't hear that part of it, but as I said, I was probably too busy screaming at her at that particular moment on all of that. Amazing. Lorraine in Lake Worth, Florida, actually, also listening to 940 AM Winds. Hey, Lorraine.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was listening to your discussion about what you call the media that had been labeling Obama as exotic. One of the things that bothers me is the truth is that this is not media. This is a propaganda machine. And I really think it's about time that we recognize that these are propaganda machines, whether it's aimed at Clinton or McCain or Obama or anybody at all. They're not news medium. They're not even infotainment medium. These are propaganda media. And
well,
we recognize this.
I would submit to you, Lorraine, that it's propaganda to the extent that it is working in its own self-interest, in the interest of the large corporations. But the infotainment part of it is the part that drives the profit for the big corporations, and that's why we don't have news anymore, because, you know, we only had news because it was mandated in 87 when Reagan stopped and, you know, did away with the Fairness Doctrine, and then in 96 when Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act. The combined effect of those two is that all of the big networks shut down their news divisions, or didn't shut them down, but they transferred them, the control of them, to their entertainment divisions and turned them into for-profit divisions of the networks. They used to be actually money-losing divisions because they were providing content that local radio and television stations had to carry in order to get their licenses renewed every year. And that's no longer the case. There's no longer a mandate to provide news. I mean, this program and talk radio in general, conservative and liberal, none of us make any – any you know, pretense that we're actually trying to be news. I mean, I've got an opinion and an attitude, and I'll lay it right out there for people. But the corporate media that is sometimes referred to as the mainstream media, calling what they're doing news, it's not. It's infotainment. So, you know, I'm agreeing with you, I guess, broadly that it's not news. I would say that the infotainment, though, has to do with the agenda of the big corporations behind it, and that's something that we need to be paying attention to. So, anyhow, Heather in Irvine, California, listening on KTalk, you've got a plug, or you want to mention?
It was to make a point about kind of what's happening in Orange County as a very red county, and how the term liberal. Mm-hmm. is being thrown around in the primary for the Republicans who are running for the nomination for state senate. They're calling each other liberals. And you know, the only liberal who's running, I think, is my husband.
Well, good on him. What's his name, if you don't mind? In fact, plug his website, if you'd like, if you got
a
liberal
who's
running.
Oh, thank you. Gary Pritchard. Our website is GaryPritchard08. The only reason he first decided to run is because no one was going to run. There was going to be no D on the ballot, and so we felt, wow. You know, it was kind of our duty as Democrats that, you know, this isn't a one-party system.
Yeah.
And, you know, the odds are overwhelming for us. We don't have the money to put into our campaign because, you know, we just bought a house, which is lost value. You know, they've got two very rich people who already have seats. One is an assemblywoman, one is a councilman, and the ugliness in their battle...
In the Republican battle. So the Republicans are fighting they're fighting for who's going to run in the general election for this. Hasn't California already had their primaries?
June 3rd is going to be local primaries. They just moved up the presidential.
Oh, okay. I see. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So your husband is the only candidate on the Democratic side.
And, absolutely.
And that's Gary Pritchard. How is that spelled?
Pritchard.
08.com.
Yeah, and he teaches at Cerritos College. He's just a teacher. We needed to get a D on the ballot. So far, they're talking about this ugly battle up in Sacramento. It was in the local paper, but they're not even mentioning that the Democratic candidate exists.
Oh my! Well, and, you know, we're going to get in touch with you, and we do our regular segment called "Taking Our Country Back," where we put on people who are running for office, and we would love to talk to your husband about that. And I find it fascinating. That Gary Pritchard, Pritchard, 08.com. I find it fascinating that the Republicans fighting among themselves are debating who's the least liberal. Is that what it comes down to?
The most.
Oh, the most. I mean, but they're using that as a club to beat each other up with.
Oh, absolutely. And they're really beating up on illegal immigration as well. And,
yeah, of course.
You know, our feeling is that undocumented workers are such a huge part of our economy. They're here. They're our neighbors. They're the people who... you know, help this state work, and demonizing them it's just ugly, and it's racist.
Yeah, yeah, well said. Thank you very much, Heather. I appreciate the call. David in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to respond to the woman who called in Monday from Pittsburgh. I think her name was Janice, but in any event, she's the one who had a 13-year-old biracial daughter that she said she would not vote for Obama. She was a Hillary supporter.
Right.
That's cutting off your nose to spite your face, because there are going to be 6 Supreme Court justices over the age of 80, and it's insanity to bring her daughter and let her grow up in a world where we have a very conservative Supreme Court, which will do away with a lot of the women's rights issues that have been won over the years.
Yeah, no matter what you may think of the candidates or their positions on specific issues,
right.
Broadly speaking, as Barack Obama pointed out yesterday, the differences between him and Hillary Clinton on issues are less than 10%, and the differences between them on who they're going to put on the Supreme Court are probably 0%, whereas the differences between both of them and John McCain are 100%.
There was another issue that you brought up on my screaming on the television set. I do the same thing, too, when Terry McAuliffe comes on and distorts the number of votes that Clinton has, which are, he always counts Florida and Michigan.
Right, and he counts zero votes in Michigan for Barack Obama, right. and the more than 50% that she won there for Hillary Clinton. I agree. That's I think over the top. But what's amazing is that the media lets him get away with it. Bill in Newport Beach, California. Got a minute before we got to hit a break here, Bill. What's up?
I was watching Rustrick this weekend, and Harold Ford put a name that should be considered by the Democrats for vice president, and that's Colin Powell.
You know, the one major downside of Colin Powell is that United Nations speech, and
I think he was lied to by the Bush administration. And when he went to the rest of the UN, I don't think he was given the information necessary. And I think he got screwed on that.
I do too. To a large extent. I think that, Colin Powell I always thought of him as somebody who has a lot of integrity. I am concerned about the behavior of his son, Michael, as the head of the FCC.
Yeah.
And the nepotism inherent in that, and the worldview, frankly, inherent in that.
Well, Colin Powell, after Vietnam, said, never get into a conflict if you don't have an exit strategy.
Yeah.
And I think he could get us out of this stupid war.
I agree with you on that, Bill, and thanks a lot for the call. But I think, just like Chuck Hagel, just scratch the surface with Colin Powell, just like with Chuck Hagel, and what you have is a very conservative Republican, even though he's right on the issue of Iraq. And so, or actually, we're not sure where Colin Powell is on Iraq. Chuck Hagel certainly is right on Iraq. 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sean is looking through the posts over at TomHartman.com on today's show blog. Her favorite post we'll announce at the end of the show, and we're going to give away a copy today, an autographed copy of one of the first books that I published. This was about a decade ago. It's called The Prophet's Way, which is actually the name of a path through the woods in Germany. The subtitle is A Guide to Living in the Now, and it's about my experiences working with Kinder and Neugen-Hilsberg Solom, this international relief organization, and its founder, Gottfried Mueller. And I think you will find it a fascinating read. So anyhow, that's over at TomHartman.com if you want to post on today and check it out. Steve in Amherst, Massachusetts, listening to WHMP. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. This is regarding the discussion about whether Oregon is or is not representative of the country as a whole.
Yeah.
Well, the Gallup polls, based on tracking during the last 4 or 5 days, last few days have been coming in 14, I don't know what it is today, but it was 14% gap favoring Obama among Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
2 days ago it was 16%.
This is nationally.
Nationally.
Right.
And that matches almost exactly the margin of victory for Obama over Clinton in the Oregon primary, which was mailed in during that same period of time.
Right, yeah, and this is the point, the Cartism of BlueOregon.com, and thank you very much for that call, Steve. This is the point that Cartism of BlueOregon.com was making, and the Jeff Allworth was blogging. In fact, if you go over to BlueOregon.com and you just go back to the older posts, Jeff's blog was called A White Working Class State for Obama, was the title of it. And Jeff, one of the regular bloggers over there at Blue Oregon, and a pretty insightful guy. And, yeah, this is an average state. And, in fact, we have a Democratic senator and a Republican senator. We have 4 Democratic members of the House of Representatives and 1 Republican member of the House of Representatives. We are below average in per capita income across the United States. We are across the state compared to the rest of the United States. And yes, Portland, George Herbert Walker Bush referred to Portland as Little Beirut. He didn't like the way he was treated when he came here. It is a liberal enclave, I'll give you that. And I'm very pleased to be living here on the banks of the Willamette River. Actually, we live in the river. Our house floats in the river, but we love it. That said, this state as a whole it's right smack down, dab down the middle. It's average. So, anyhow, Eddie in Portland. Speaking of
Portland. Hi, Tom. Hey, Let me tell you that I love your show. I listen to it almost every day, and I can tell you, you are an honorable man. You are educating America, and that's an honorable act.
Thank you, Eddie. Thank you for that.
I am from Portland. I am Hispanic American. My wife, she's Cuban American. My son is Puerto Rican, Cuban American. Mm-hmm. And the three of us, we all voted for Obama. Because we believe that he is about to bring the revolution of the mind. And I just want to say to all those talking heads in corporate media that it's Obama time. So get with the program.
That's interesting. Eddie, do you mind if I just ask you a quick question here before you go?
Sure.
First of all, I agree with you. I think that there's a revolution of the minds going on. Frankly, I think that people who are voting, many people who are voting for Hillary Clinton as both a woman candidate and as a woman who, and as a candidate who is taking far more progressive positions than her husband governed under. I think that that's a revolution as well. I want to tip my hat to both campaigns, but your point is well made. But you said that I believe you said your wife is Cuban. I'm curious about your take on Fidel Castro in Cuba. I'm just so fascinated by that. It seems I was talking with a friend in New York the last time I was back there, who is a second generation Cuban, and she said her parents are all, you know, they absolutely hate Fidel and hate the regime, and her generation, the second generation, who don't know Cuba but are the, you know, the but have been watching the news, don't know really what to think about it. What's your take on what's going on in Cuba?
Well, my in-laws, the one who is still alive, which is my mother-in-law, she's from the older generation, and I mean, she hates Fidel and all that, resembles Fidel. But I mean, my wife and I also believe, and so is my son, that I mean, this embargo situation is crazy, and I mean, the U.S. has to put an end to this.
Yeah, it seems to me the best way, because I deplore the suppression of free speech and political freedom in Cuba. I think it's absolutely wrong, and I can't imagine anybody defending it.
But the
best way to break that down is to break down the embargo, in my mind.
Definitely. And one thing that I want to tell you, Tom, my wife, she has family in Cuba, and I mean, she speaks to them over the internet very frequently, and it's not that much. I mean, Cuba has been opening little by little.
Well, tourism with Canada and Europe is bringing a lot of folks
and that picture hasn't been presented to us here in America.
Yeah.
I mean, they are still presenting Cuba as the old hardliner Cuba, but I mean, it has changed a lot, and we are not being told the truth.
Yeah, so you think things are starting to crack open. I appreciate that, Eddie. Thanks a lot for the call, and thank you for your kind words. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina, listening on WOIC 1230. Andre, we only have about a half a minute before we got to wrap this hour up. Quick point?
Sure. I'm really concerned, Tom, at the military buildup around Iran and the propaganda coming out of the administration about Iran's intent to build a nuclear weapon. The IAEA, on December 3rd, 2007, said that, to the best of their knowledge, the Iraqi nuclear program was shut down in 2003. They're literally
the Iranian, you mean,
lying to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Bush is preparing for an assault on Iran, and he thinks that that's going to bring the hard right back to McCain, that he thinks that this is going to be a great gift. And he may well be right. Attacking Iraq was of tremendous political benefit to the Republicans in 2000, running up to it, in 2004, running on it. In 2006, it started becoming a little more of a neutral thing for them, although they were still able to use it. This time, it's killing them. But I think these guys still think that, you know, more war is the way to win. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, and sometimes, as the Firestone Theater points out,
you know that you're wrong, but
But you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
And thinks that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible? Dr. Stephen Fry, as in medical doctor, MD, from the University of Nevada, School of Medicine, is the author of a new book, which Dr. Dean Adel, also an MD, says is the most important book of the new millennium. 25 Reasons to Legalize Drugs, We Really Lost This War. Dr. Stephen Fry, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be on my first national radio show with you, Tom.
Oh, well, thank you. And I should note your website is 25 Reasons, as in the digits 25reasons.org.
Correct.
For the book and for the information. And, sir, this is a brilliant book. First of all, I should add, by the way, you're going to be speaking at the Libertarian Convention on Thursday?
Yes, they invited me 9 months ago, before the book was even finalized. They got word of it. And I am not a libertarian.
Yeah.
But this is an issue that they have been philosophically in favor of for years.
Oh, sure.
And what I have provided them is the data to show that their position is absolutely pragmatically correct.
Yeah, and you really have. Let's just go through some of these things very quickly. Number one, the absurdity of a war on drugs to begin with. We've really lost this war, you say.
But it is a real war. More Americans have been killed on the war on drugs as we approach Memorial Day than all of our other wars combined.
Killed how?
How have they been killed?
Yeah, you mean killed by drugs, killed by gangs, killed by police, killed by being put in prison?
All of the above. All of the above. Tom, drugs don't kill people. The drug war kills people. Our teenage murder rate is 19 times higher than in the Netherlands where drugs are legal. One-third of people in prison are dead by age 45, even if they went in for a non-violent, simple using marijuana charge.
Yeah.
The gun battles on the street between gun dealers, the drug business is a violent business.
You know, my dad grew up on the south side of Chicago, and he used to go down to Al Capone's speakeasy, one of the speakeasies there, to get a bucket full of beer to bring back to his father, you know, and the guy sitting on the stoop, and talked about the violence during Prohibition. I mean, Americans remember the gangs and the violence and the Al Capones during Prohibition. Why don't we put two and two together and say, hey, maybe if we decriminalize drugs, that kind of violence in our cities would go away?
Absolutely. For 11 straight years after the end of Prohibition, I think it was 1931, the murder rate went down consistently for 11 years in a row. And when the drug war began, the murder rate followed it right up.
Now, you talk in your book, we're talking with Dr. Stephen Fry, his website 25reasons.org, his new book, 25 Reasons to Legalize Drugs. You talk in your book about how the devastating impact of the war on drugs on women and that it's really been more destructive to minorities than slavery was.
Absolutely. I have a whole chapter called Racism Worse Than Slavery, and Bill Cosby spoke to me about it for about 15 minutes when he was in Reno here about 9 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Slavery was wrong without any question, but the slave owner, for all the wrong reasons, took good care of the slave. He was a business investment. If he couldn't go out and pick the cotton, the slave owner lost money. So he took good care of the slave and the slave's family. The more children, the more slaves he had. And what we have done in our modern society is we have absolutely devastated black families and entire black communities. We take children away from their parents when mom does a little pot or dad does a little coke, and we put them in foster care. The death rate in foster care in the United States is 4 times the death rate of children who are not in foster care.
You talk about the spectacular success in the Netherlands.
Absolutely.
In fact, we had the chief of police for Amsterdam on this program, I think 6 years ago. I think it was when we first started. And he was talking about how they couldn't actually decriminalize all drugs in the Netherlands because of the European Union, but they basically just ignore the laws.
Exactly. And the United Nations and the United States has continued to pressure them. And the United States drug czars have lied for years about the success of their legalization. Tom, the only thing that has ever been proven to work to reduce drug use and drug demand is treatment. Incarceration accomplishes absolutely nothing. Two-thirds of prisoners are rearrested within 3 years, and one-third of prisoners are dead by age 45, which means essentially we rehabilitate and kill the same number.
Wow.
It's
now,
unbelievable.
Now, we're talking with Stephen Fry, Dr. Stephen Fry, 25 Reasons to Legalize Drugs, his new book, and the website 25reasons.org. Dr. Fry, I get it. You know, I certainly would sign on in a heartbeat with pot, for example. I mean, I'll just say personally, if pot was legal, I would use it rather than alcohol, frankly. I think it's
safer.
And
it's so much safer than alcohol.
That's why I would, that's the point. It's safer to the body. Go ahead.
The two most dangerous drugs in our society are legal, and they are cigarettes and tobacco and alcohol.
Right, and tobacco is, my understanding is that nicotine is 5 times more addictive than heroin. My question to you is, where do we draw the line?
Let me explain it. Your response of that I can support legalized marijuana but not the other drugs is the most typical educated response, because our government has been brainwashing and propagandizing us for so many years.
Well, see, I can see decriminalizing all the other drugs, but I'm not sure
Let me explain to you what happens with the criminal approach. Number one, we support the terrorists. I have a whole chapter called Narco-Terrorism, and the drug cartels are major supporters of terrorism. So as long as we have an illegal market, we are supporting terrorism. And furthermore, when you legalize drugs, the Netherlands and Switzerland have proven the demand goes way down.
Right.
Let me ask you a question. How often do you think about doing heroin?
Not very often. I mean, that's in the United States, the heroin was, a legal over-the-counter cough medicine in the 1920s.
Absolutely.
In fact, that was the original brand name. Yeah.
It was not a problem. It's when you make it illegal that somebody has an incentive to give you a sample and get you hooked and make you sell to other people so that they can support their habits.
So, and cocaine was sold over the counter. In fact, cocaine was the original stimulant ingredient in Coca-Cola, thus its name Coca-Cola.
Exactly.
But
yes.
Isn't there a point where let's draw the distinction between decriminalization and legalization. If
yes.
you decriminalized all these drugs,
yes.
then you would still have an underground market in them, but it wouldn't be such a profitable one that you'd have shootout wars and things over it. If you legalize them, then you may have corporations coming in like you have with tobacco saying, we can make money getting people hooked on heroin and getting hooked on crack, and so let's do it.
It's very easy to, just like we don't sell alcohol, it's much easier for kids to buy marijuana than it is for them to buy alcohol. We have turned a million of our teenagers into drug dealers. This is unbelievable. As long as there is such a huge profit margin, there are going to be people that are going to take advantage of that as a way to make a living or to make a lot of money either way.
Right, but my distinction between decriminalization and legalization, can you address that? I mean,
we may be talking about the same thing. Sometimes it's just terminology. If we're going to make it available in legal state-run stores and tax it and control it just as we do now with alcohol and with prescription narcotics, then we may be talking about just a grammatical difference. The problem with the United States is that our drug enforcement agency and criminal justice system is so dependent upon drugs that it's hard to believe that they would do as they do in the Netherlands. They'll continue to find ways to harass citizens, continue to find ways to move it underground. When it is legalized, decriminalization is what they have in the Netherlands, but it's de facto legalized. They sell it all.
But see, there's the difference is, well, yeah, actually, right after 9/11, that Christmas, we took our three kids to Holland, to Amsterdam for Christmas, because the deals were just spectacular. I could cash
Absolutely.
In Frigga Flyer miles and get there for nothing because everybody was afraid to fly. And, we went into a 5-star hotel or a 5-star restaurant, a fancy white linen tablecloth. The guy brings by the wine list and the pot list. And we're sitting, our kids are all grown up now, and I'm not going to tell you how the story ends, but, here's the wine list, here's the pot list. Now, it's technically illegal, but this is the fanciest restaurant right next to the Rijksmuseum in downtown Amsterdam.
In coffee shops all over the Netherlands. Let me ask you a question. Did you see a single ghetto when you were in Amsterdam or the Netherlands?
No, I didn't, and
they don't have any.
Yeah.
As a result of legalizing drugs and not having the crime that we have, they don't have ghettos.
Amazing. Stephen Fry, M.D., Dr. Stephen Fry, the website 25reasons.org, 25 reasons to legalize drugs. Thank you, doctor, for being
on
the program.
Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it.
Good luck with your book. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Should we decriminalize drugs in the United States? Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
My proposal is really quite simple. It's legalized drugs as they're naturally grown.
I agree.
That means we could marijuana, peyote, mushrooms, and coca would all be legal.
Yep.
But we'd
but anything that's chemically altered becomes a essentially a prescription drug.
Yeah, and well, what we do is most people get the kind of high they want from the free stuff. But then you prohibit processing of these drugs, these
right.
plants. So you can't have heroin, meth, or cocaine. They'd still be illegal. You also prohibit all financial transactions. So there we'd eliminate almost all the violence, theft, because if it's all free, you're not going to have any theft problems because of people trying to, you know, pay for their high.
Right.
And you'd also eliminate a lot of the border problems.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is, and I tell you, having worked in mental health for years, that there is a small percentage of the population, and there's a big debate in the mental health community about whether it's 2% or 10%, but there is a small percentage of the population of people who are, whether you want to call it addiction prone or whatever you want to call it, they're going to use something to modify their consciousness throughout their entire lives. And actually, arguably, well over 90% of the population does that. It's with drugs called caffeine and alcohol. But there's this smaller subset that are very vulnerable to nicotine addiction and that will seek out things to alter their state of consciousness. And some would argue actually even function better with altered states of consciousness, or at least with the ability to occasionally have altered states of consciousness. And there's big arguments about, you know, is this genetic? Does this have to do with the dopamine receptor genes, the DR genes, DRD2, the dopamine transporter genes, the DT genes? Does it have to do with serotonin levels, all this stuff? But nonetheless, bottom line is there are some people who are going to be seeking drugs.
And there are benefits from these drugs.
Yeah, exactly.
I've seen firsthand the thing of marijuana with cancer patients. It was amazing
yes.
to see the difference
yeah,
when actually a doctor said, hey, he needs to smoke some dope.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden his appetite came back, a lot of the nausea went away and so forth. It's happened many times.
Yeah, and we
so
saw
there are,
this
there are benefits from these.
Yes, and we've seen that with a friend with cancer and also with a friend with MS. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good point, spot on. Bill in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bill.
Hi. I don't think you have to worry about legalization so much because if drugs like opium were legal, people are not going to run out and use heroin or morphine. They're going to use opium in its milder form, you know, the smoked opium.
Right.
And
well,
there's a substantial
difference between, you know, it's like, you know, why did Rush Limbaugh go all the way to what was the drug he was using? I'm forgetting the name of it, but the extreme, you know, it was virtually heroin. In fact, it's referred to as hillbilly heroin. Why did he use that instead of, you know, something milder? Oxycontin, that's what it was, yeah. You can tell I'm not a big fan of it. But in any case, you know, why did he use that instead of, you know, codeine or you know, one of the, you know, Tylenol or something like that? I mean, isn't there... Don't you think that there would still be people seeking out the stronger forms?
Rush Limbaugh was, in my opinion, a recreational user who just allowed his habit to get out of control. He wasn't a psychological impaired person.
Yeah.
But that's not the point. The point I'm making is that, once you legalize opium, people would then have the choice to use the milder form,
right.
the smoked form, which is there's no profit to be made in smoked opium.
Yeah,
right
no, I agree with you, Bill. And in fact, you know, back in the 1800s and back in the 1700s, when this country was young and there was I remember reading Thomas Jefferson's letters. He was talking about how one of the guys who was associated with the revolution was pretty useless because he was all the time smoking opium. And, you know, he was into opium. And, you know, there were charges of others being alcoholics, but, you know, opium was certainly around back then. So, anyhow, thank you, Bill, for calling and raising that. Interesting. Jack in Detroit, Michigan, listening to WDTW at 1310 a.m. Hey, Jack.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
You know, I think since this country is so obsessed with putting things in financial terms, we're going to have to end the drug war by using a carrot, like put it in financial terms. I mean, you've got an imprisoned industrial complex that profits from the imprisonment of people, and these corporations are becoming super rich at the expense of people's freedom.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if we want to talk about drugs and the correlation to terrorism, I mean, let's talk about, you know, let's bankrupt them.
Yeah, no, spot on, Jack. And, Jack, it's not just the prison industry. I remember back in the 70s, I had a friend who lived out in California who was selling these little test kits to see how strong, basically, your pot was or your cocaine was or whatever. He was selling them in High Times magazine. And, you know, it was basically a little business out of the back of his garage. The guy was a chemist. It was perfectly legal, and he was just selling, you know, reagents, chemicals that would detect these things. When the drug wars really kicked into high speed in the 70s and they started mandating testing, he ended up, this guy's a multimillionaire now. I mean, you know, because he's taking 15, 20 cents worth of chemicals and selling them for $35 a whack to companies that are legally mandated to test for drugs. People, you know, high school teachers and
which is wrong.
Yeah, I know. It's become a $1 billion industry.
What people do in their private time is their business.
I agree, Jack. And my point is that there are so many dimensions that people don't even realize to the profit being made on this so-called war on drugs. It's not just the prisons. Although that's a huge piece of it. There's a lot of money being made. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, you can talk to me. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Our program, by the way, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. You can find out more about that at teamster.org. And strange goings on out there in Republican circles. Ed Gillespie, remember him? The former head of the Republican Party, the White House counsel. Ed Gillespie, he says on Fox News, get this, on Fox News, Ed Gillespie says,
our concern is, frankly, and I raised it with you when you have people like Keith Olbermann and Chris Matthews and MSNBC, and the frequent blurring of the lines between commentary and advocacy on their part on behalf of certain candidates with the NBC News division increasingly commingling. There may be a spillover effect here that is disconcerting. Ed Gillespie on Fox News complaining that the news isn't the news anymore.
Yeah, very strange. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Terry in Seattle, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Terry.
Yeah, I wanted to bring into the conversation an article that was in the Seattle PI, which I'm linking and going to send to you. But it was about a gentleman in Seattle who had been smoking pot because of hepatitis C and complications and needing being on a liver transplant.
Mm-hmm.
He was denied a transplant even though he had insurance, even though one was available by all people that do it here because he smoked marijuana.
I'm sorry. Because he smoked pot, Terry?
Because he smoked pot with a legal prescription.
With a legal prescription. They turn him down for a transplant? I don't understand why they could do that or how they could do that.
It's in the Seattle PI. FBI, and it is a 552008 was the date, and they denied it. The University of Washington.
Terry, if you have a link to that, text link. Well, just post it on our blog. Just go to TomHartmann.com and today's show blog. You can just post the link, and
I'll link it right now.
Yeah.
But they told him to stay clean and come back in 6 months.
When he may be dead.
Less than a couple of weeks to die. And this is one of the big, big reasons that we're being discriminated against, or they are.
Yeah.
I, as a hepatitis C person, I don't smoke the pot, but I do also know that they discriminate because they have mental health issues.
Yeah.
So,
Terry, thank you.
Conversation.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that. Depressing news, but thanks for sharing the information with us. Richard in San Diego. Hey, Richard.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening to your conversation with Dr. Fry, and when I was an undergrad, I lived in the UK, and at that time, addiction was considered an illness and was covered under the National Health Program. If you wanted to be an addict, you had to register as one, and you would get they would prescribe medication for you, which you could get at the pharmacy for free.
Well, in fact, you could get heroin for 10 cents a dose, as I recall.
It was also mandatory that you receive counseling if you registered as an addict.
Yeah.
And while I was there, during that time, I was an undergrad, I didn't see any evidence of any illicit opiate trafficking.
Yeah. In fact, I think it was 60 Minutes. There was one of the big networks about a decade ago did a substantial special on that. And, you know, a 20, 30-minute segment, maybe a half hour, maybe an entire hour program where they profiled that time in the U.K. when if you were a heroin addict, you could get a prescription for heroin. And what they found was, first of all, that they were startled that there was this large number of just average people who had gotten addicted to heroin, typically as teenagers when it was illegal or in college when it was illegal. And now they were, you know, lawyers and doctors and professionals in many cases. And they were continuing to use heroin, but legally and safely now. And the other thing was that over half of them, and this went completely against conventional wisdom and completely against the experience with nicotine, over half of them themselves stopped using it, just spontaneously said, okay, that's it, I don't want it anymore. And the other half were quite functional, thank you very much, in society once it was available to them on a decriminalized basis. Now, as I recall, was it Maggie Thatcher who rolled that stuff back, or is it still in place? I don't know the status of that in the UK right now.
I don't know. I just observed it when I was there as an undergrad.
Yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't any deaths from overdoses because it was all pure, pharmaceutical grade opiates
that
they prescribed.
Right. So people weren't mistakenly taking the wrong dose when. Richard, thanks a lot for the call and for the information. Ira in Tannersville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ira.
Hey, Tom. I'm nearly 60 years old and I'm a professional, and I've known since I was a teenager that recreational drugs ought to be decriminalized. I've known hundreds and hundreds of professionals over the years who've used recreational drugs, and to us, the drug laws are a joke. They serve only two purposes. One is they make certain people very, very rich. The other thing is that they can be used to oppress the lower socioeconomic classes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They make a pile of money for a small number of people, and they make a large number of people very poor and disenfranchised, and particularly in those states where you can't vote if you've been convicted of a felony, they even strip people off the voter rolls. So, you know, spot on, Ira. Well said. Rich in Winnemucca, Nevada. Hey, Rich.
Ira, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for having my call.
Sure.
You there?
Yeah, I am. You're
okay.
On the air.
What I want to talk to you about, Dr. Comments, and he was talking about treatment. One of I am in a treatment provider. One of the things that has happened over the years that people have been delegated basically treatment. You go in and pay $30,000 for treatment, and they tell you to go to 12-step meetings. There are much more effective meetings out there, much more effective ways to get a person into and away from their addiction. So
you're suggesting that the 12-step programs, which are generally free, are the most effective treatment programs?
No, they are not the most effective.
Oh, okay. So
there are other programs out there that are more effective. They're evidence-based, cognitive behavioral. There's other programs called Smart Recovery. And one of the things is with that, too, with treatment, for court systems cannot direct somebody on parole or probation to a 12-step meeting because it has been
deemed a religious organization by the federal government.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, you know, Bill W.'s, the first rule is the greater power thing. Interesting.
Right.
Rich, thanks a lot for that. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin.
Long time.
Hey, it's been a long time since I've heard your voice. How you doing?
Hey, I know you're doing well.
I am, and I'll get better.
I'm
I hope you will,
there.
Too.
It's like... To say we're busy is an understatement, but anyway, thanks for asking. I'm going to go on record. I totally disagree with legalizing them.
I disagree with legalizing them. I'm in favor of decriminalizing them, and there's a difference. I don't think that I don't want the Coca-Cola company putting cocaine back into Coca-Cola.
Okay, well, look, I'm not with decriminalizing either, and I'll tell you why. Okay? Culturally speaking, when he's talking about the Netherlands, okay, that's a much, much different culture than what we have. And I look at it like this, Tom, look, stop. If you decriminalize it and make them legal, what's the incentive going to be? And you know people, you know human nature, you're a smart person. You know people, there's some among us, and me possibly included, I admit it, that overeat. There are people that overindulge in alcohol. There are people that overindulge in all this. So if you put the bar down, the standard, and make it more lenient, and my thing is, and set up a society that's going to accept it, and...
But Dr. Fry's point, Armin, was that if you regularly use or abuse, depending on how you want to define it, pot, you're not going to destroy your liver. Whereas if you regularly and seriously use or abuse alcohol, you will. You can die from abuse of alcohol.
Okay.
You can't die from abusing pot. So why is pot illegal?
You make a point about that, and I would criminalize. I don't like alcohol. I think it's a horrible thing. And if you really did an extensive study on the social cost of alcohol that we're not even aware of, you know, there could be strong... movement, I think, in favor of making it criminal again. And, you know, I know it's widely accepted and it's been a big part of this country.
But that's the problem, and that's why prohibition won't work, is again, just like pot can grow as weeds, alcohol is relatively naturally occurring. If you let something ferment, you're gonna have alcohol. Armin, I appreciate your call and thank you for your perspective. And it's great to hear from you again. Rama in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Rama.
Hey there, Tom. I just wanted to say I totally support what y'all are saying, and I'm a personal friend of Tommy Chong's. Please go to his website, aka TommyChong.com.
Okay.
He is promoting his DVD that describes in detail what he went through the incarceration and the subsequent trying to discredit him.
Right,
and
yeah.
The whole issue.
This is a guy. This is a guy. This is an example of the system run amok, and it's an example from somebody who has a podium. I mean, the average person who gets caught up in the drug war has no opportunity to tell their story, and in fact, you know, ends up poor, broke, and can't even vote in many states. What is the website? AKA TommyChong.com. Did you say?
That's right, and go and support his video. Watch it. It's incredible.
Okay, Rama, thanks a lot. It sounds like you've been enjoying the video a lot, shall we say. 1-866-303-2270. We will have, coming up right after the break, the winner of our contest today, Sean's favorite post on our blog over at TomHartmann.com, the Daily Show blog, who will receive a copy, an autographed copy, of my autobiography, essentially, The Prophet's Way, which is not about my being a prophet or anything crazy like that. A Guide to Living in the Now. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartmann Program. Burns, 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 the ring of fire.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. And we have a winner in our Sean's favorite posting on our blog over at TomHartmann.com today contest. We got to come up with a fancier name for the contest than that. But anyhow, Sean Taylor, our executive producer.
Tom, there were so many good ones in there today. It was kind of hard to choose, but here's the one we picked. Matto the Hun, who says, I like the Obama is an exotic candidate meme. Who doesn't like exotic? It's kind of a weird, in parentheses, and completely not sexual turn-on, so long as he doesn't start wearing pasties.
Mm-hmm. So congratulations to
Matto the Hun.
There you go. Indeed. And you will get a copy of The Prophet's Way, A Guide to Living in the Now. And thank you, Sean. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Michael in Seattle. Hey, Michael.
Hello.
You are on the air.
Oh, wonderful. I didn't believe I got on the air. Tom.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to mention some of the medicinal properties that opium has, especially one that most people don't know about, is if you take like a common pain pill or anything, opiate compound, it cures your cold as long as you're on that compound.
They're antiviral?
Yes. Well, they I did research on opium. I discovered this during research that junkies said they never had a cold while they were junkies.
Huh.
And I went into it more, and it seems that somehow the it is antagonistic to the cold germ, viral germs.
Oh, that's very interesting. Michael, thanks a lot for the info. Never heard that, but you look back in the 18th, 17th, and 18th centuries, and an awful lot of the cold remedies had opium at their base. So, you know, maybe. Van in San Francisco listening on Green 960. Hey, Van.
Hi, sir. I was calling to kind of make a point. I think that decriminalization is probably a good idea. And what I was thinking is what they should do is maybe tax it and use the money from the tax for education, for drug rehabilitation, for police, and then if there's anybody's caught selling it, of course you send them to hell or whatever.
Right. I think your point is well made, Van. The biggest thing that the British discovered when they decriminalized heroin and they made it basically a cheap prescription drug,
right,
was that the petty crime rate dropped by, as I recall, I've got 34% stuck in my head. I might be wrong, but my usually I remember numbers pretty well. But there was a substantial drop in the petty crime rate because people no longer had to have, $30, $40, $50 a day or the British pounds equivalent for their habit. They could do it for 10 cents with a physician. And so they weren't breaking into cars and houses and stealing stereos and things like that.
Yeah. What I meant was using the money towards, fighting criminals that are selling, basically selling drugs like illegally the violence and stuff. Also, another point is I had a buddy growing up whose dad was with the Justice Department, and they were talking about legalizing drugs, and what he had said was that they could never do it because of all the people that would lose jobs. They were saying that most of the court cases have to do with drugs, and the judges and the lawyers and the people for incarceration would all end up losing their jobs, and it would basically bankrupt the state of California.
Yeah, well, that was my earlier point, is that there is a huge industry associated, and Van, thanks a lot for the call, associated with the criminalization of drugs, from the private prison industry, which is the fastest growing domestic industry in the United States, building private prisons. That's the fastest growing domestic construction-based, it's not, as opposed to the service industry. Some parts of the service industry or the computer industry are growing very rapidly. But when you look at old-fashioned, let's put up buildings types of industry, the private prison industry is the fastest growing in the United States. That should give you pause. And this is by and large because of the so-called war on drugs. Ariel in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX 1480 AM. Hey, Ariel.
Hey there, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
Let's see. I'm 23 years old, and I've lived in a variety of states myself, and I'm not a listener you usually get, but, I am for the decriminalization of marijuana, big surprise, and it's not because of my age range or anything. I believe that after all the states that I've lived in, I think that, although it would be probably a difficult transition for the federal to govern, the decriminalization of marijuana or any other kind of drugs like that. I think the states could make a very smooth transition, and cities like Denver, where it is decriminalized, I think that'd probably be more beneficial. And I'm going to go comment on Arlen, your buddy earlier.
He was stating
that about human nature and how it would be impossible for us to deal with that kind of society and probably go chaotic and everyone's going to be an addict. I don't think it would be like that. I guess I trust in human nature just a little bit more.
Well, go back and look at the literature of the 1700s and the 1800s. There wasn't, every newspaper story wasn't about the crazed opium addicts or the crazed coca leaf chewers, even though you could walk into any five and dime store, you know, the equivalent of your corner store. You walk into any store and pick up legal opium or cocaine.
It's about normalcy. I mean, after a while.
No, that's the bottom line. Ariel, thanks a lot for the call. I've got to move along here. Connie in Silverado, California, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to shout out about Ambassador Joe Wilson coming to town to talk on behalf of Hillary Clinton. You wanted to make an announcement about
that? Thank you very much. Yeah, we're trying to turn Orange County blue, and it's been a rough ride, but I think we've got a good foothold. Joe Wilson is coming out to support Ron Shepston, who's trying to unseat Gary Miller, who's on Crew's top 20 corrupt list.
That's even better. I thought, you know, I knew that Joe Wilson was in favor of Hillary Clinton. I thought it was just for her. This is for a local congressional or for a congressional candidate.
Yes, it is.
Great.
We're trying to get Congress back where it can function and work, and we're working really hard with Mr. Shepston, and Joe Wilson is coming out both on tonight, and I know it's a little close, but coming out near Irvine Lake.
Yeah, we can't give a phone number, but if you can just say where it is, then or if there's a website.
Bree Walker's hosting one tomorrow night in Beverly Hills.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. Connie, I appreciate the call, and check it out. If you're a Democrat in Orange County, I'm sure you can track down the information. Coming up tomorrow, William Yeatman, energy policy analyst with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, is going to tell us why high gas prices are caused by, you guessed it, polar bears. That should be an interesting conversation. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.